and always streaming on the Civic Media app.
This is CBS News on the Hour, sponsored by O'Reilly Auto Parts.
I'm Michael Wallace. The Trump administration has taken another step to dismantle FEMA. CBS's Nicole Skanga has learned the agency's employees will have to submit requests for contract extensions.
The decision impacts thousands of FEMA's core employees, tasked with delivering disaster assistance before and after hurricanes, tornadoes, wildfires, and other federally declared emergencies. Notably, the first responders are uniquely funded through the Disaster Relief Fund, which allows them to operate when disaster strikes through government shutdowns.
The National Weather Service is warning of a critical risk of fire weather in eastern New Mexico and southwest Texas, and an elevated risk in the central and southern plains. Mike Covina lost his home in Mumford, Oklahoma last week.
Once the house caught on fire, about 10 or 15 minutes, it burned.
At least three people were killed and 15 injured in a mass shooting at a park in Las Cruces, New Mexico. Mayor Eric Enriquez.
There's no place for violence like this in our community.
Las Cruces Police Chief Jeremy Story.
The investigation so far reveals that there was an altercation between two groups of people, and that altercation escalated to gunfire between both groups. Several other people were also injured in the crossfire.
The Pentagon is still fuming over the New York Times report that Elon Musk was there yesterday to get a briefing on a war plan against China. Here's Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth.
There was no war plans. There was no Chinese war plans. There was no secret plans. That's not what we were doing at the Pentagon.
CBS's Charlie Daggett reports the Pentagon's investigation into leaks could include polygraph tests.
The brief memo referred to, quote, recent unauthorized disclosures, but did not specifically identify the alleged leaks in question. But it came on the day that Elon Musk visited the Pentagon amid reports furiously denied by President Trump and the defense secretary and others that Musk was to receive a classified briefing on China.
A federal judge is spending the weekend deciding whether the Trump administration was justified in using the Alien Enemies Act to deport suspected Venezuelan gang members.
David Beer, director of immigration studies at the Libertarian Cato Institute, says there's no reason to believe the Trump administration's claims about the deportees.
We know we cannot trust any assertions that they're making.
He says even if people could,
that would not be any excuse for doing away with due process for people accused of being in the country illegally, accused of being gang members.
Beer says despite statements by President Trump that there is proof that most of the men are violent criminals.
It's not a legal fact true until it's been proven in a court.
Allison Keyes, CBS News, Washington.
You can hear more on the CBS Weekend Roundup podcast. This is CBS News.
Think O'Reilly Auto Parts for all your car care needs. Get the parts and service you need fast from the professional parts people at O'Reilly Auto Parts.
Hi, this is Beth, inviting you to join me for The Kitchen's Open, the show within the show, each Monday morning at 9 a.m. on The Morning Show on WFHR.
For Civic Media News, I'm Savannah Tomei Olson. Postmaster General Louis DeJoy is joining forces with Elon Musk and his new government department to cut 10,000 jobs at the U.S. Postal Service. But staff are pushing back. Nadia Ramlagan reports.
American Postal Workers Union President Mark Diamonstein says older adults, veterans, and others depend on the service's commitment to deliver mail to everyone, regardless of where they live, noting the Postal Service delivers to every address in the country, 169 million addresses, and 318 million pieces of mail every day.
Part of the effort on Thursday is to make the postal customers around the country fully aware of this threat, to what belongs to them.
In a letter to Congress, DeJoy said the agency needs help with lease renewals on its retail centers and tackling the issue of counterfeit postage. The Trump administration has also floated the idea of privatizing the post office. Supporters argue the change would make the Postal Service run more efficiently and save money. Polling from the Pew Research Center finds 72% of Americans have a favorable view of the Postal Service. Local unions in Kentucky are participating in a National Day of Action tomorrow. Diamonstein explains that more than five decades ago, postal workers won collective bargaining rights. He says the union is prepared to fight back on any attempt to weaken union rights or target worker protections and working conditions.
It's also very important, I think, for the public to be reminded that good living wage jobs help our communities. They help make them stronger. That good jobs turn over in the community to restaurants, to small retail stores, to housing.
According to the APWU, privatization would eliminate more than 600,000 living wage union jobs, including those of more than 70,000 military veterans. That's Nadia Ramlagan. I'm Savannah Tomei Olson for Civic Media News.
Enjoying this local program? Find the complete Civic Media lineup at civicmedia.us or the Civic Media app.
I'm meteorologist Mace Michaels. Cloudy with a rain and snow mix possible tonight and a low near 30. More on the rain side tomorrow, maybe a little snow mix late in the afternoon and evening, a high to the low 40s. Warmer into next week. Some 40s to start, then 50s and 60s later on in the week. Currently 35 degrees.
Jane Matinair and Greg Bach.
Coming up on the show, we've got Angela Lang from Block here as our co-host for the day. Also, Representative Darren B. Madison, and This Shouldn't Be a Thing. Join us.
Matinair on air, weekday mornings at 10. This is locally grown radio, WFHR.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
From the rolling bluffs of the Driftless region to the pristine shorelines of Superior in Michigan, from the Northwoods to the Kettle Moraine, Civic Media broadcasts across all of Wisconsin. For all of Wisconsin. Take a trip with us across the radio network to hear from communities throughout the state. This is the Civic Media Spotlight.
Welcome in to Hour 2 of the Civic Media Spotlight. First up, we'll hear a segment from Mino and the Mayor out of Green Bay. Jim and John welcome on Cardi Josephson from the Walk to End Alzheimer's, who also brings along a special guest, former Wisconsin Governor Marty Schreiber. Governor Schreiber has recently penned a book called My Two Elaines about the story of caregiving for his wife, Elaine. He writes about having to watch his beloved wife gradually transform from the woman who had gracefully entertained in the executive residence to one who sometimes no longer recognizes him as her husband. Net proceeds from the sales of My Two Elaines will be used to promote Alzheimer's caregiver support programs. Here's their conversation.
Now, back to Mino and the Mayor. Here's John Mino and Jim Schmidt.
Hey, thank you very much. Welcome back, Mino and the Mayor. The Mayor, of course, still on vacation. We got Dennis Peters filling in for us, and thank you to Mark Hewson. Well, right now, we've got a couple of people that are also involved in a very, very serious thing that, again, I swear affects somebody in everybody's family. Cari Josephson, of course, from the Alzheimer's Foundation, the Walk to End Alzheimer's coming up, and a very, very special guest. We are honored to have this gentleman, and I'm going to leave that to you, Cari, to introduce this very distinguished gentleman.
Yes, my sidekick for, well, yesterday and today, former Wisconsin Governor, Mr. Marty Schreiber.
Yeah, good morning.
Do you want a drum roll, Marty?
You're the first governor we've ever had in our studio.
Is that right? Well, thank you. That's quite an honor then for me to do that.
I didn't want to say this should be one of your top honors in your career, but
yeah, and by the way, I see a happy birthday. Is the day your birthday?
It was St. Patrick's Day.
Oh, St. Patrick's Day. Well, happy birthday.
Thank you.
If I would have known it, I would have signed an executive order for being so intelligent and wise.
I work with a former mayor of Green Bay here every single day, and he's never given me an executive order.
Yeah, well, that's
I think he tried setting one to get me out of town one day. Uh-huh. But
was that a restraining order?
Well, maybe that's what it
was.
Is
that what it was?
One of the two. But, Cari, thank you for this beautiful food from Uncle Mike's.
You are welcome, John.
It will not
happy
go to
belated.
Waste. Thank you so very much.
You bet.
First of all, I want to talk to you, sir, I'd like to talk to you about this book that you wrote. I'm a local author, and I like to write books. But this one, I think, is a very poignant personal story of how you got involved with the Alzheimer's Foundation in a way, because it was personal with your wife, correct, sir?
That's correct. And I'll tell you, had it not been for the Alzheimer's Association, quite frankly, I don't know how I would have made it. My wife experienced and died from Alzheimer's over a period of almost 20 years. And in that period of time, I went through what every caregiver goes through, and that's just the grieving, the anxiety, the worry, the depression, the sadness, the feeling of abandonment, the lonely, all of those things come into play. And if it wouldn't have been for the Alzheimer's, I wouldn't have made it. But the title of my book is My Two Elaines. And the first Elaine is a wonderful woman that I married and had, you know, 4 children, 13 grandchildren, now 11 great-grandchildren.
What a beautiful woman.
But the second Elaine, same person, began to appear when she was approximately 63, 64 years of age. and she would get lost driving to and from places she had been going to and from for 10 years. A great cook mess up recipes so badly she would cry, coming up with stories that I couldn't believe she would even imagine. That was the beginning of the second Elaine. And there were some things that I learned too late. We missed out on moments of joy. We could have had greater opportunities to experience helping each other live our best life possible. But I was arrogant. I was self-centered. I said I could do it alone. And I tell you, I got involved with the caregiver's poison, a little bit of alcohol. And all of a sudden, it began to dawn on me that I was not really serving the one I love by being so self-centered. I was not serving her by refusing to ask for help. I was not serving her by not taking care of myself. So that's why I wrote the book. I want to help caregivers learn, cope, and survive.
But that comes from a place of love, though. You know, you want to be the one that takes care of things. You want to be the one, because that's the role that you do when you say, I do, you know, and to do those things, I think that's very commendable. But yeah, you're right, though. I think it does add up after a while, and it can become, you know, out of your wheelhouse of what you can do. And it's only natural. And I'm just glad that you, like you say, you found the association to help you with
that. But I think, on the other hand, too, I think it also opened your eyes just how tough of a foe this is.
Yes.
Because everybody thinks, well, I'm the strong guy. I was governor. I can handle this. But Alzheimer's is such a tough enemy, isn't it, Carrie?
Oh, absolutely. And just caregiving in general, whether you're caring for somebody with Alzheimer's or dementia or any other situation, it takes its toll, and you really can't do it yourself. It's about really having a good support team around you.
I think everybody knows somebody who has been affected by
everybody.
It. And that's it. It didn't used to be like that. I think it's something that's kind of growing. There's more and more diagnoses.
Yes, exactly.
And it's horrible.
Yes. We're living longer, but also we're getting better about diagnosing it.
One thing I want to make everyone aware of. 40% of caregivers die before their loved one due to stress-related illness.
Really?
A person who is a caregiver has a 60% higher death rate than non-caregivers.
What?
So what the point is that when there is a diagnosis of Alzheimer's, there are two patients, the person who is ill and then also the caregiver. And unless we realize that, we're going to just see caregiving among all of the things in the world is probably one of the most challenging. Because of all of the emotions and experiences you go through as you see your loved one disappear almost daily. And my heart goes out to every caregiver, to every family who is dealing with this Alzheimer's disease. And that comes us right down to what Carrie is about, and that is to help people better learn, cope, and survive, making sure we get the research involved. And if I could encourage anything, it's to get involved with Carrie, the Alzheimer's Association, and their walk.
You know what? I've just in the ones in, from my family members where I've dealt with this, okay? The one thing that, again, why this is such a vicious thing is because there will be moments of total clarity of you're talking to that exact same person you've known your whole life, and then 10 minutes later, you don't recognize the person. They don't recognize you. That's got to be an extremely frustrating feeling, right?
Well, so Elaine was in assisted living for roughly 8.5 years, so we're having lunch. And she's beginning to cry. And she looks at me, and I said, why are you crying? Well, she says, I'm beginning to love you more than my husband. Well, I didn't ask her what's wrong with her turkey husband. I didn't do that at all. But the point is, and what is so important, it was not necessary for her to know my name in order for our hearts to touch.
Sure.
And many times people say, well, that person doesn't recognize me. Well, I don't want any. No, hearts can touch by holding a hand, by giving a hug, by singing a song, by giving a smile. And so people could please understand that.
I've learned that, too.
I just want to reintroduce you. We're with Carrie Josephson, Alzheimer's Foundation, Marty Schreiber, former governor for the state of Wisconsin, who wrote a phenomenal book. It looks like My Two Elaines, talking about learning, coping, and surviving as an Alzheimer's caregiver.
That's a beautiful picture of the two of you, by the way. That's fantastic.
Well, thank you. That goes back, maybe when we were 22 or 23 years old. And I know I look only 39, but I'm 85. But you can get sort of a pushback.
I think it's a beautiful thing that you said regarding the conversation with your wife, that I've learned something, too, of what you meet them where they're at. And from that point, that's where you can get the traction on the communication and whatnot. And I think it's a beautiful thing that you shared that.
Okay, what you just said is brilliant. It's the key to it, joining their world. As long as we try and keep them in our world, it's impossible.
Right.
And so, but to join them where they are at is one of the most important, best things you can do, both for the person ill as well as the caregiver and the entire family.
Carrie, could you put that into words, what you've seen in people doing that?
I think what Marty's talking about is, you know, sometimes people, you know, they get a diagnosis and the caregiver maybe don't understand exactly, you know, what they're dealing with. And, you know, it can get tiring when the person is repeating themselves or asking the same question over and over or saying something that's not at all correct. But it's really about not battling with them. You know, does it matter if they think that it's 3 p.m. instead of 9 a.m? I know Marty talks oftentimes about his wife wanting to have a glass of wine in the morning. Who cares? Just roll with it.
Before I went to print with the book, I find a series of notes and journals that Elaine had been keeping. Each chapter begins with some of Elaine's notes or journals. That gives us a thorough understanding of what it's like to be diagnosed with this disease, to have all of those questions come into mind, to think you're normal, to not think you're normal, to worry about whether or not things are going along, what's going to happen in the future, and then to get angry with. People have told me that that book has really made a difference in their life, helping them learn, cope, and survive. And the notes that Elaine wrote that are in the book gives us that kind of insight.
What is the process like of going from, I think maybe I'm not quite, not like I used to be, for example, how does that process start to getting diagnosis aspect of it? I mean, what kind of time span are we talking about? And, you know, from that aspect, what was your experience like?
Well, she was getting lost, as I said, going to and from places. And I was in refuel, you know, I didn't want to accept that. I didn't want to accept
denial,
that at all.
Kind of?
I was denial. Yeah. And so we finally went to a family doctor who said, you better check this out. And so we went to a psychiatrist. They have what they call the mini test. What day is it? Who's president of the United States? Do you use real cream for your hair? All those kinds of things.
I'm just throwing it out there.
My talents.
You know, I got these. Okay, I'm reading these things from her notes.
Yes.
Wow, you're not hiding anything with what she said here.
I didn't want to.
It's a true.
Yep.
I got this one. Date unknown, but this is from your wife, Elaine. I wish my Alzheimer's would dissipate. I'd like to be the smart wife and mother I used to be. Now I have to waste so much time just trying to figure out what I should be doing without seeming as smart as I used to be. I need to rely on Marty for everything, and I'm very lucky he continues to keep me. Life gets more difficult every day.
And so if you read further, she gets to the point where she gets very angry with me because she felt I was controlling her. I want you to know that when we had prayed together and we had cried together, but until I read her notes did I ever understand the courage that it takes to be diagnosed with this illness and go forward. And never did I realize that. Elaine, it didn't happen on a Thursday. It happened on a Friday. Elaine, it wasn't the Smiths of John. What is going on is, why is she being criticized for thinking things? She didn't know what she said when she said it. And so I wrote the book. I want to help caregivers learn, cope, and survive. I want to have that journey, as challenging as it is, to be as fruitful and as productive of happy moments as possible.
I just want to read one thing. I believe this is from you, a little excerpt you have in there. What I wish I had known, asking others to help does not mean you're not strong enough or not trying hard enough.
I try and drive home the point that to ask for help means you're not giving up. And also to not ask for help is a sign of arrogance.
Okay, one more I want to read. I should have enlisted a couple of friends to be my team captains who could do the asking and scheduling for me. That's a very practical thing in that aspect.
Well, there again, it's a selfishness. I can do it myself.
Right.
And in the meantime, I'm sort of digging my own grave because I'm not taking care of myself.
Wow, this is fascinating. We got to send her a quick break. We'll be back with more. Carrie Josephson and Marty Schreiber, former Wisconsin governor, walk to end Alzheimer's. We'll talk about that when we come back. Okay, Carrie?
All right.
Great. Thanks.
Got my chips cashed in, keep
trucking. Mino and the Mayor is part of the Civic Media Radio Network and airs on WISS and WGBW weekday mornings from 6 until 9. To learn more about this show and all of Civic Media's programming, check out the website at civicmedia.us/shows. Locally grown radio, WFHR.
I'm Dan Schaefer. Let's recombobulate. Folks, we've got to talk about Derek Van Orden. The second-term congressman representing Wisconsin's 3rd District is at it again, dodging public meetings and making all kinds of unhinged comments.
As many scramble and struggle to understand the chaos of what's happening in Washington, D.C. and how it's impacting people here in Wisconsin, Van Orden has been as frustrating and disrespectful as ever. In one instance, Van Orden took to social media to berate a veteran who had been fired from his job at the VA by Elon Musk's Department of Government Efficiency. And the veteran in question is simply someone who was just reaching out to his congressman, looking for answers. Van Orden's office has also hastily canceled public meetings, and he has made some especially wild accusations about people who have been attending these public events. Congressman Van Orden needs to stop this unhinged madness, and more importantly, be more available and accountable to his constituents.
Find all of Dan's work at the Recombobulation Area and on our website at civicmedia.us. You're listening to locally grown radio, WFHR.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
Next up on the Civic Media Spotlight, we go to the John and Gordy Show down in Madison. Every week, John and Gordy talk with Pam Yonke, the fabulous farm babe and host of the Midwest Farm Report. This time around, they talk chocolate milk and also a new study out showing just how rural Wisconsin is these days.
WMDX 92.7, John and Gordy in the morning, broadcasting from the capital city, Madison, Wisconsin.
Mm-hmm. Chilly start this morning, about 33 degrees. Highs today in mid-50s, a mix of clouds and some sunshine. We'll check in with Brittany Merlot in about an hour and get the latest on the weekend weather. Right now, Pam Yonke is with us. Good morning, Pam, from Midwest Farm Report.
Morning,
how you doing?
Yep.
Good.
Doing good. I was talking to somebody yesterday that came through the building, and they were a little bit shocked at our weather. I'm like, wait a minute. Yesterday was the first day of spring. I said, right. It's Wisconsin boys basketball. I said, if you're a homer like me and grew up in this state, you could just about predict what we were going to have with the weather this week. So safe travels to everybody that's coming back to Madison for the rest of the playoff weekend.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah.
Of course, yes.
Let's hope they're drinking a lot of milk while they're here.
I was telling you guys that's one thing that we've been kind of bringing up in conversations from time to time, how the Dairy Farmers of Wisconsin is one of the strong messages you'll see in a lot of the sport venues for high school athletes, is reminding them that chocolate milk has been scientifically proven to be one of the best ways to recharge after a workout. And a lot of school systems, through the help of their dairy farmers, have actually put coolers in their locker rooms so that when the athletes come off the field or off the floor and are kind of looking to rebuild after a game, they have nice ice cold chocolate milk to help their bodies do it.
Well, I love chocolate milk.
Yeah, me too.
It's the best. It really is. Didn't they take it out of the menu for a while, the school lunch menu?
Oh, yeah. Very rarely will you see chocolate milk on even the low-fat chocolate milk. It has a dilly of a time trying to get onto school lunch menus. That's kind of a never-ending anthem out in Washington, D.C. by a lot of dairy farm advocates, is trying to just get the right milk into schools at the right temperature in the right containers to keep it attractive to kids. It's, semantics.
It is. Mm-hmm. It is. Well, now there's a new research facility that you mentioned to us off the air, and they're taking a look at the real makeup of Wisconsin's rural community. And this sounds pretty interesting, actually. What did they come up with?
I did a poll this morning on my early show and just asked people, do you think Wisconsin is still rural? I mean, if you think about it, a lot of us are of the age where we might have grown up rural, but obviously Wisconsin's dynamics have changed quite a little bit. So there's a group called the Rural Policy Institute. It started last July. It is not an advocacy group. It's not a lobbying group. It's basically a group that's trying to answer these kinds of questions for policy development in the future. They're not going to introduce policy or anything like that. They just want to be a think tank of sorts to try to provide information in areas where there hasn't been any. This is one of the first things that they tackled. And basically what they found is you've really got to define what is rural. I'll give you an example. So you guys know where Waupaca is, right? Up in the central Sands area. Okay, now that's a perfect example of rural adjacent, they call it. So Waupaca's probably, I don't know, I haven't looked lately, but it's probably got a population of about, what, 5 to 10,000 people, right?
That sounds right,
It's in kind of the middle of nowhere, no disrespect to the central Sands, but Waupaca is surrounded by rural. So those are the kinds of things they're pointing out. Same thing for some of you that go up to Rhinelander. Rhinelander's probably got a population, maybe 10, 12,000, but it's surrounded by rural. So what they've done in this scientific breakout is take a look at population densities and where they're at in Wisconsin. And it looks like it's about 40% very rural, probably about another 20% we could call rural adjacent. You've got about 40% your Green Bay's, La Crosse's, Eau Claire's, Madison's, Milwaukee's that would be urban. And then you've got the remaining percentage that are in kind of the suburbs, shall we say. But it's really all designed to try to make sure that people that are elected from areas like Milwaukee, Madison, Green Bay, pay attention to the fact that the policy that they're putting in play has a major impact on rural and rural adjacent citizens.
Well, that's interesting.
Interesting study. Yeah. Pam, we got a question from a listener. Let me throw this question in the mix here from a listener. John and Gordy asked Pam what we can do to protect family farms from huge corporate farm takeovers. That's kind of a big question, but what's your take on that?
Maybe we tackle that at another time. I think it's a question that's worth discussing, but it's a big one, and it all goes back to a lot of it is family dynamics. What are you going to do if the kids don't want to farm? Mom and dad can only do it for so long. You have to try to come up with a succession transition plan. Maybe you reach out to the kids' neighbor friends that's still farming. That's what I've mentioned to you guys before. I get riled up a little bit when people say we're losing farms. We're not losing farms. They're just looking different. The cows go to the neighbors. The land is rented by the neighbors, but that farm is still there. So I appreciate the question. I really do. And we talk about it a lot, but it might be a little big for us to tear into in a couple minutes on the Gordy and John show.
Gotcha. Oh, thank you for getting the billing right on the name of the show. Appreciate that.
What's that?
Never mind, John. All right. You missed it.
I'm just, I was actually just contemplating the other topic we were going to talk about, and that is the milk movement. You know, what is that all about?
Well, really, it's kind of helping consumers better understand how dairying is changing. Now, Wisconsin is still obviously very robust. We're number two in the nation as far as milk production, but things are changing. We're starting to see big, major cheese plants going in places like South Dakota, Kansas.
Wow, Dakota. Kansas?
Strange things like that. And I'm not just talking little ones. These are whoppers, fellas. And it's something that we've got to kind of keep in mind when it comes to Wisconsin's dairy competitive edge and making sure that we're recognizing, you know, just like our lives on a daily basis, the dairy industry and its look and its flow of milk changing, too. We might be sending some Wisconsin milk to Kansas to help them power that cheese plant that they're bringing online. But like I said, I thought it was worth reminding people that, holy Moses, milk moves a long distance in the United States, and we're lucky we've got as many cheesemakers in Wisconsin to use local use of it.
Well, that champion cheesemaker was from Wisconsin. He's now in another state, originally. So we're importing the cheesemakers and now the milk, so what the heck?
There you go.
All good. All right, Pam. Well, thank you very much. We hope you have a great weekend. We'll talk to you again Monday morning. Thank you.
All right, buddy. It's always a pleasure. Have a good one.
You too. Pam Yonke from the Midwest Farm Report. That's actually coming up right around the corner right here. And then it's Idiocracy time on John and Gordy in the Morning. WMDX for a Friday. Good morning.
The The John and Gordy Show is part of the Civic Media Radio Network and airs on WMDX weekday mornings from 6 until 8. To learn more about this show and all of the Civic Media programming, check out the website at civicmedia.us/shows. This is locally grown radio, WFHR.
CBS News Brief. CBS News has learned the Trump administration will require many FEMA employees to reapply for their jobs. Bob Deans with the National Resources Defense Council is concerned.
The administration is intentionally hobbling the nation's ability to prepare for and respond to wildfires, hurricanes, heat waves, and other disasters.
Several areas of the country are at risk for wildfires right now, including some plain states. North Carolina's Forest Service has issued a burn ban.
Until we see a significant amount of rainfall in the form of inches, this burn ban is going to remain in effect until further notice.
No arrests have been made after three people were killed and 15 wounded in a mass shooting at a park in Las Cruces, New Mexico. Police Chief Jeremy Story.
There have not been arrests or anyone detained. We have leads that we're pursuing, but we are also asking the public or anyone that might have information to please provide that.
The victims were attending a car show at the park. CBS News Brief. I'm Michael Wallace.
This is your local